I'm going to make the claim that the stuff we're talking about over the next 4 weeks is dealing with the most important issue facing humanity. There you go. You are in this place tonight wrestling with a question that is the most important question facing humanity. Jesus, who is he? Now, my job is actually, you may not have come thinking that's the case, but my job is to help you see that that claim isn't outrageous, it is simply stating a fact. That it is, in fact, the case that this is the most important issue facing us all here tonight and everyone on the planet. So it is fantastic you're here. I trust you find it helpful. It's so important. I'm actually going to pray to ask God, who I'm convinced is real, that he might help me be clear. And you'll be glad of me to pray that prayer. So how about if it's not your practice to pray, just listen in. But I'm going to bow my head and I'm going to pray to a God, I think, who does actually hear our prayers. And how about we do that? Our God, we want to come before you tonight and ask for your help, please. And I particularly want to ask your help. Please help me be clear. Help me speak what is true, but help all of us pay heed to the things of such monumental significance. Help each of us tonight put aside all the distractions, all the other issues that are rolling around in our lives, and help us, please, each of us spend just this short time focused on this question, who the Lord Jesus is. Help us consider these things, please, we ask, and we ask it in his name. Amen. Well, for some months last year, as Andrew mentioned, we went out into the community and asked the question, who do you think Jesus is? And we got a bunch of different answers and we took the top four. So these things we're looking at over the next weeks, did Jesus exist and was he anything more than just a man and so on? Should we even care? These are the issues that people actually raised with us. So we talked to people and lots of people on the Central Coast said, we're not even sure he exists. So what we've decided to do this whole month is take the issues raised by you, the community, and see what can be said about them. Now, I think I'm understanding right. We'll have time for questions. I'm looking at Andrew. Is that? Yep. So hopefully we'll have time for questions too. So we want to engage on this. And so as we're going through, if things kind of puzzle you and you go, hang on, how come? Then jot it down or try and remember and we'll have a moment at the end for questions. This one is fundamental, of course. And I want to start looking at it. Did he even exist? By going right left field. So I'm going to kind of come in at it in a way that kind of looks a bit weird to start with by telling you about outrageous claims. There are a number of ways you can make a claim, and life is full of outrageous, extraordinary claims, but there's different kinds of claims. And I'm going to suggest actually two kinds of claims that you can make. Let me tell you the claim about the shipwrecks in Wales. What's that got to do with did Jesus exist? We'll get there in a second. But in December the 5th, 1664, so many hundreds of years ago now, December the 5th, 1664, there was a shipwreck off the coast of Wales in a particular strait that's there, and all 81 passengers on the ship died except for one. And the survivor, the only survivor, was a man, and his name was Hugh Williams. Now, some almost, or over 100 years later, December the 5th, same date, 1785, a shipwreck happened in the same place, off the coast of Wales in this particular strait. Everyone on board, 60 men and women, died. There was only one survivor, and his name was Hugh Williams. Then, almost 100 years later, in 1820, on August the 5th this time, the same place, a shipwreck occurred. All people on board died. There were 25 of them on this smaller ship. There was only one survivor, and his name was Hugh Williams. Now, that is astonishing. Now, it's not astonishing because I'm suggesting there was a man called Hugh Williams who lived a really long time. You know what I mean? And he's a guy that you don't want to sail with when he's on a boat in Wales. But I'm not suggesting that's what makes it amazing. Someone did think I was saying that through the week. They thought, oh, you're saying a guy lived for 200... No. Now, it's an amazing claim that three shipwrecks, the only one survivor, each time named Hugh Williams. Extraordinary. Now, what will happen with this? Some of you will go home tonight and do the research. You'll hit Google and you'll go, Hugh Williams, shipwreck. And you'll chase through Google and Wikipedia. And, of course, you trust Wikipedia, yeah? It says everything that's true, and whatever Google comes up, you'll go, yeah, oh, wow, it's true. Now, some of you will do that, and you'll come back convinced that it actually happened, and man, you'll be telling all your friends about it, and you'll think, this is awesome, it's true, it happened. But others of you will go, no way. There's no way stuff like that happens in our world. It's too extraordinary. I'm not even going to chase it down because I just know things like that don't happen. So you'll go, it doesn't, I can't believe it. Others of you, a third group, will say, I don't care. Now, I think that'll be most of you. You're going to go, so what? As long as I don't meet a Hugh Williams, I don't really care what's going on. Do you know what I mean? Now, there are lots of amazing claims that people make about things in history. And for one kind of claim, the Hugh Williams shipwreck kind of thing, there's three possible responses. I'm convinced. I'm not convinced it's not true. I'm not convinced it's not true. Or I don't care. Three valid responses. You can legitimately walk away and say, who cares whether Hugh Williams and all of that's true. But there's a second kind of claim and a second kind of amazing claim that only has two possible responses. And now we're getting closer to the issue at hand. You're visiting your parents one afternoon. I don't know, you've dropped home. And the door knocks and no one in the house goes to the door because you're there, so you go to the door. And there's a couple of people at the door, a man dressed in a suit and a woman dressed in a business clothes and so on. And they hand you an envelope politely and tell you that inside is the deed to this house that your parents are living in, that you grew up in. And the deed is the genuine deed. It was discovered recently and it shows that the house, your family home, is actually owned by a lady in Sydney. And in 4 months' time, she's moving back and the police will be evicting you and you better get out. Whoa, you take the envelope and you walk back into the living room, into the family room, where you know your dad's sitting there watching the cricket with a beer in his hand and he's just going, and you say, look, this couple of blokes at the door, the lady, woman and lady at the door, and they've given me this deed saying this house isn't yours, it actually, and he says, just tell them I'm not interested. And you go, what? No. They're saying this house is not ours, and in 4 months' time, the owner's actually coming and kicking in. We don't feel it. We don't feel like we need anything like that. We're okay, thanks. No. You don't understand. You see, my point here is this. There are some kinds of extraordinary claim that you only are allowed two options. You either believe it's true or you deny that it can be true, but you can't have the option of, I don't care and I'm not interested. I'll give you another one like it. There's a bomb in the building. It's set to go off in 3 minutes. I know we spent a lot of time building this thing, but that's how we fly. bomb in the building, 3 minutes. Now, two possible responses, not a third. One response is, I believe it's there. Believe it's going. We've got now 2 minutes 30. I'm getting out. None of you clearly believe it, but the second response is, I don't believe it. And so I'm going to sit here. The third response is not really a third response. The person who says, I don't care, is really saying what? Think about it. They're really saying, I don't believe it. You can't say of an imminent disaster that someone's claiming is going to happen to you, I don't care, unless you're terminally insane and irrational, or you don't believe it's true. Now, my point is that there are some claims in that order. Because of the consequences and impact they have on your life, to say, I don't care, to try and sit on a fence, is really only possible because you're convinced it's not true. If you were convinced it was true, you wouldn't say, I don't care. And the only other real option is to say, I don't believe it, which is the same as saying, I don't care. Now, tonight's issue is exactly that second kind of claim. It only has two possible responses. Because it's of the order of Matthew 21. Here's where we're coming close to the text. Come with me to Matthew 21. Now, if you've got your EV News as you walked in the door, it'll be in it, and I'd love you to have a look at it. Have a look at a bit of the Bible with me tonight. If you've never looked at the Bible, it's a great thing to do. Astonishing. I'm actually going to unpack some of the significance of the Bible in a moment, but have a look there at Matthew 21. Words of Jesus. He gives them a story, and it is just a story, but he's using the story to tell something about reality. And he says that there was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a wine press, it built a watchtower. He set up this whole house and he put some tenants in it. And then when it came harvest time, he sends a servant to collect his rent, some food, fruit. But look what the tenants do, number 35 there. The tenants seize his servants, beat them, kill them, and stone them. So the owner sent more servants to them, more than the first time. The tenants treat them in the same way. Last of all, he sends his son. They will respect my son, he said. But when the tenants see the son, they said to each other, this is the heir, the owner. Let's kill him and take his inheritance. Then all of this can be ours. So they took him, threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. And it's a simple story. But let me tell you what Jesus is saying here. Jesus is saying that I am the son of the owner come back to the world, to this nation and to all humanity, from God saying, I've come to collect. You are living in a world that was made for you. You are living in a world where you're experiencing everything that's only a gift given and lent to you by God. And he has sent me, his precious son, to call you back. What are you going to do with me? What are you going to do with me? Now, Christianity is in essence a claim about reality. It's a claim about facts. It's not a claim about feelings or values or a way of life or morality. It's a claim about an actual event that took place in history. Christianity is grounded in that event, not an emotion. It's a claim about an event in history where a man came into the world and said something outrageous about himself. I am your God. The Father, I'm the Son, we made you, we own you, it's our world, and we've come to collect. Now, that is an astonishing claim for someone to make. But I want to labour a point for a moment just to keep banging away at that. What is Christianity? The way most people talk about it, Christianity is perceived to be a lifestyle choice. It's perceived to be, you know, I'm lonely, pathetic, struggling in life, got no meaning and purpose, and I'm just at all at a loose end and depressed, and I'll get some religion, I'll get Christianity, and it'll all make me feel better. And so, you know, you want your kids to get a bit of religion so that they'll have a bit of moral and value structure to their life. It's about lifestyle, it's about feelings, it's about emotion. Biblical Christianity, the true thing, is profoundly different. It is a claim about the identity of a person who lived in history. It's a claim that that man owns the world and owns you and owns the universe. You were made for him. It isn't a claim about feelings. It impacts your feelings. That's why we sing about it. It's extraordinary. It impacts your feelings, but the first Christians went around the ancient world proclaiming a fact about the identity of this person, not their feelings. They went around saying, this Jesus is the one. Now, that therefore elevates the issue we're considering tonight. Did this man even exist? Well, if he didn't, if Jesus didn't even exist, then Christianity as the Bible's given us disappears. I mean, you can still have popular religion called Christianity, but that's not the same thing as what you get in the Bible. It's a different beast. But you take Jesus out of Christianity, it's like taking the ball out of golf. All you've got left is a walk. Do you know what I mean? Like the essence of the thing is, and which is probably not a bad thing to do to golf, but do you know what I mean? Or the whole idea is to smack this ball. And the essence of Christianity is Jesus. You take Jesus out of Christianity, you've got nothing left. It's not Christianity anymore. it's popular religion. Now, this is so fundamental, Jesus' place in Christianity, that you get the sense that many people are picking this up who are opposed to Christianity. You get the sense they get this because the way they oppose Christianity is by starting to question the very existence of Jesus himself. Now, it's only a recent thing. I'll show you a couple of slides. There's a whole bunch of books have come out in recent times, The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins and so on, The Atheist Manifesto and what have you. Various books have come out suggesting, in some of them at least, that Jesus didn't even exist. You get the Discovery Channel. If you have your pay TV, Discovery Channel has done documentaries in recent years on whether Jesus existed or not. You've got skeptic websites that are talking about these kind of things. And the perception that you might get from all of this is that there's considerable uncertainty amongst the scholars about whether Jesus even existed or not. Some writers play on this. Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, says this, quote, "A serious historical case can be made that Jesus never lived, as has been made by Professor G.A. Wells of London University." Ooh, that sounds impressive. A university professor is making a serious historical case. And you kind of go to yourself, you go, man, what chance have I got if scholars in universities are arguing about whether Jesus lived or not and some people are saying a case can be made that he didn't, what chance have I got, just a lay person who's got no, how can I ever work it out? It's all too hard. And you're left with the impression that if they can't, I can't. And so you figure God will understand if I don't really try and understand it, because it is just too... Look, let me cut to the bottom line and show you how I got there. Now, the bottom line is a bit of fun, but I'm going to give you the conclusion and then give you some working. It comes from the input of a man called John Dixon, Dr. John Dixon, who's a fellow of ancient history at Macquarie University in their history department there, which is quite a profound and deep work in the University of Macquarie there. 2 years ago, he on his Facebook issued a challenge. He said publicly, if anyone could find one reputable scholar from an established university that doubted the existence of Jesus, he would eat a page of his Bible. Now that's a pretty cool challenge. And so it actually went viral because it was so awesome. You know, we're going to make this Christian eat his Bible. And so a guy called John Saffron, as some of you will know, he had 50,000 followers on his Twitter thing. And so he tweeted it, here's a chance. And so he sent it out, let's get this going. And all his 50,000 followers then they picked it up and it ran down through their next. It went global. And John said responses flooded in. And initially they came from atheists who were kind of, I don't know if you can say this, but they were licking their lips at the thought that he would have to read his Bible. And they're kind of going, it was all, you know, which part of the Bible are you going to get smashed? And all these kind of comments were coming in. Initially, there's a whole host of atheists kind of gloating. And then a trickle of candidates, you know, a university professor who claims that Jesus didn't exist. And here they were. He said he got a professor of philosophy suggested who didn't believe that Jesus existed. But he was a professor of philosophy, not ancient history. So he didn't work in the field of ancient history. He was just someone who sat in a room on smoking a pipe. But there was another one who came in. He was a professor of... And an internet university. He gave out internet degrees, do you see? Hardly a reputable university in the world. There was a professor of English literature, 19th century English literature. That is to say, a man who worked in the field of studying writings from the 19th century had made a case that Jesus didn't exist. And hardly someone who works in the field of ancient history. After tens of thousands of hits, and now 2 years later, I rang John this week to check if this is the case. He said there's not been one academic working in the field in a reputable university anywhere in the world who doubts the existence of Jesus. Now, I want you to feel the weight of that. You've got to feel the weight of this. See, in any field of thought, you know, in science, history, geology, kind of thing, it's usual to find a majority scholarly opinion and a minority one. You know, like global warming. There's a majority of scientists who say it's happening and it's man-made and so on. There's a minority that differ with that. You get a majority and a minority. So there's a debate between scholars over issues. On this issue, the existence of Jesus, there isn't one reputable scholar working in the field of ancient history in any university in the world who doubts the existence of Jesus. There is no minority scholarship position. Now, at one level, that's not saying a very great deal, because it is like saying there's not one scholar that doubts the world's round. Well, of course there isn't, because it's such an indisputable fact, it's obvious that no one would deny it. Not a reputable scholar anyway. Well, the point is exactly that. Despite the sensationalist books and programs, the evidence is so simple, so clear, so overwhelming that there's not a scholar in the world, reputable working in the world of ancient history in any university, who denies it. Now, let me give you, there's the bottom line. Let me give you a taste for the evidence that they've gone to draw this conclusion that Jesus clearly existed. The evidence for the existence of Jesus falls into, well, a bunch of categories. Literary evidence, that is written evidence by his followers, written evidence by people who didn't follow Jesus, archaeological evidence, and circumstantial evidence. Now, we can't go through it all, but I'll give you a quick taste of it and we'll throw it open for questions. Let me show, firstly, there's here's the 11 documents that people look to in the world of the study of ancient history for evidence that Jesus existed. Now, these are writings of people, men, who weren't Christians. This is not Christian material at all. These are a series of authors and documents that were written by people who didn't follow Jesus, who were Jewish or Greek or Roman or so on. Let me give you a couple. Now, they're of varying importance. The earlier ones, you can see there, AD 55 and so on, the earlier ones are obviously more significant than the later ones, although the later ones aren't very late. Let me give you a taste of these, and I'm going to go through it fairly quickly, but let me show you Tacitus. Tacitus, next slide comes up. Tacitus was Rome's greatest historian. And if you look closely in that, you can see how he's written about Jesus there. You've taken my thunder. Tacitus was a Roman historian, not a Christian. He wrote the Annals of Imperial Rome. He wrote it about 150 AD. We have it in our hands, and he's actually if you do history of the Roman period in school, most of what you learn about the emperors of Rome comes from the writings of Tacitus. That's where we get a lot of it. Now, in one section, he's explaining the persecution of the early Christians, and in passing, he mentions Jesus. It's because Nero, who was a Roman emperor, had set fire to some of the city, and to deflect blame from himself, he accused the Christians, who were hated for their enormities, Christus, which is just another way of saying Christos in Greek, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea in the reign of Tiberius, and so on and so forth. He mentions Jesus in passing. Let me give you another one. It comes from Maribar Serapion, and he is also is not a Christian man. Let's jump into there. In a moment, their land was covered with sand. The quote has been cut off. He's talking about the problem of three different societies killing their wise men. And so he talks about... it's just escaped. Two other wise men who were killed and the impact that happened. So the previous one he's talked about, their land was covered with sand as a consequence. What advantage did the Jews gain? Here's the third one. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just after that the kingdom was abolished. He's talking about AD 70, the destruction of the temple. There is a reference to the news about Jesus, again by someone who's not a follower of Jesus. Let me give you Josephus, move quickly through this. Josephus was a Jewish historian. He was writing around late first century. He mentions Jesus twice in a document called the Antiquities of the Jews. Now, again, we just have this in our possession. It's an ancient document that we've got. And he talks about Jesus, a wise man. He did wonderful deeds. He talks about Pilate and so on, various truths about the person of Jesus. Come along to the next quote. In another place in these documents, he talks about the brother of Jesus, Jesus who was called the Christ, the brother being James, who was actually, he talks about him being executed. Not any propaganda. He's just mentioning these as historical events. Now, there's clear literary evidence for the existence of Jesus outside the Bible. Add to this some archaeological evidence. 5 years ago, or thereabouts, this is now from memory, in a high-security prison in Megiddo, which is in Palestine, they were doing renovations in the prison. Now, if you know anything about Palestine, I mean, if you dig a hole just to stick a pot plant in, you're going to strike some ancient artifact. The place is just riddled with all this kind of stuff. And so in this high-security prison, they were digging to do renovations, and they came upon the ruins of a house that they dated back to the very early 2nd century. So we're talking 100s in that kind of period of time. And they found that this house had itself been renovated. So we're talking ancient, ancient history, a relic from thousands of years ago. And what they found was that this house, its walls had been smashed to make the room bigger, and inscribed in kind of mosaic form on the tiles of the floor was a dedication to Jesus as God. Now, that is astonishing, astonishing for a bunch of reasons. The first one is this: early Christians were into building programs. Now, how cool is that? So they were expanding their buildings to fit more people in. That's actually trivial. But what's extraordinary is that very early on, we have evidence in hard concrete evidence, tiled evidence, that not only did Jesus existed, but he was regarded as God by the early Christians. Now, why is that significant? Well, I'll tell you why it's significant. Because one of the popular myths that does the rounds is that the Christian idea about Jesus and who he is a legend that formed over time by Chinese whispers. Do you know that thing? Someone whispers to you that Jesus had a dog. Do you know? And the next person said, Jesus had I think it was a dog. And you do this whispering down the line, and at the end of the line, it turns out Jesus was God. People claim that the message of Jesus just started as this bloke who was this ordinary nice guy, a great teacher, and as the copies and talking to each other went down through the centuries, this legend developed of him being much more. And if he knew what had happened, he'd be turning in his grave. And in fact, it goes farther than that. Some people suggest that the early church in about 325 AD at a council at a place called Nicaea, they made it all up because they wanted to bolster their power base as a church. And so they got rid of all kinds of documents that didn't agree with what they wanted to say, and they kept only the ones that actually said what they wanted, and the whole thing was made up through Chinese whispers. Now, here's the problem with that. First piece of problem is that we've got a house with a mosaic tile a long time before any of those events saying they believed in Jesus and believed he was God. Way before any opportunity for legend to develop. I'll give you another little piece of evidence. This is a very raw one. It's only just come to light in recent times, and there is still some debate about this one. But there is a burial box. So when someone died in the ancient world around the time of Jesus, a lot of times what they'd do is they wouldn't bury the whole body in a coffin like we do. Once the person had died, they'd collect their bones and put it in a smaller box called an ossuary. It was much more compact. And so they've dug up this burial box that's dated back to AD 70, thereabouts. And inscribed on the side of it is Joseph, brother of James, brother of Jesus, son of Joseph. Now, that's astonishing. Now, the fact is that there is the Jewish Antiquities Office are doing a study on it, and is it a, you know, what do we make of it and so on. They're still wrestling with the significance of it, but this kind of evidence is beginning to come to light. Now, so you've got the writings of people who weren't Christians talking about Jesus. You've got archaeological evidence talking about Jesus. The other big major piece of evidence is the writings of Christians themselves. Oh, but hang on, you say, you can't count that, because the writings of the Christians were the Chinese whispers thing, and it comes from so late, and we've only got copies of copies of copies, and how can you know what the originals really were, and it's just changed and changed and changed. And well, let me show you some information about the Bible. And I'm going to do this particularly because over the next weeks, we're going to be looking at the Bible, and I want you to know how profound the evidence for the Bible is. Yep, flip through, thanks. I'll do it by comparing it to some other ancient works. So Plato, a man who lived some centuries before Jesus, he wrote, and what he wrote, the book that he wrote, or the scroll that he wrote, it rotted away. But before it rotted away, they made a copy of it, a new copy. And as it rotted, they made another copy and another copy. Now, we don't have the original that he wrote. Obviously, it's gone. We don't even have a copy of the original. We don't even have a copy of the original. They've all rotted. But what we do have is 1,200 years after he wrote, we have copies. Okay, medieval times. Now, they're very old manuscripts, but they're 1,200 years after the original. But we have, you can see, half a dozen or so copies of what he originally wrote, and scholars working in the field of ancient history are able, from that number of manuscripts, to compare and work out, you know, where there are differences in the manuscripts and what that suggests about what the original was actually, and they can reconstruct the original from the documents we've got, and are fairly confident that we've got what Plato actually wrote. I'll give you another one, Caesar. Caesar wrote the Gallic Wars, now not long, some decades before Jesus, not centuries before, some decades before Jesus, and it recounts his war in Gaul. And again, we don't have what he wrote, but we have copies of copies of copies about 1,000 years after, and you can see how many manuscripts scholars were able to piece together from that what the original actually was. Come to the New Testament. The documents about the life of Jesus, about what he said and what he did, were two things. Were written within about 15, 20 years through to about 30 or 40 years after the life of Jesus. That is to say, the events of Jesus were laid down in hard writing in a very short time after the events that they're recording. There was very little chance for the Chinese whispers thing to have through the oral transmission before it was just written down and locked in place. More than that, we don't have the original. So John wrote about the life of Jesus. We don't have the original that John wrote. It rotted, okay? But what we do have is a fragment of a copy of John's gospel dating from 30 years after he wrote. Can you see the difference? We have manuscripts 1,200 years after Plato, 1,000 years after Caesar. We think they're pretty good. In the New Testament, we have documents, fragments within 30 years of the original. It's chalk and cheese. But get this, within a few years further, click the next one, we have numbers of manuscripts that are copies of the originals, and we have in those various manuscripts whole books of the New Testament, perfectly kept. Now, they're not the original, but they're copies. But get this, in a few more years, look how many we've got. Now, we couldn't draw enough books to give a sense of it, so you times the number of little pictures by 100 and you'll get 13,000. Verses 7, verses 10 or 11. It is embarrassing, the wealth of manuscript evidence for the reliability of the writings that we have in the Bible. Now, let me give you another sense to how powerful this is, because you might think to yourself, well, what? That's not much good, because, okay, a scribe copies the original and makes some mistakes. So what if we've got 13,000 copies of a mistake? How does that help us? Well, it's not as simple as that. Let me explain what happens. And to do it, I'll give you a bit of background. Imagine we had three lines of 20 people. And with this line, we've got a paragraph kind of series of information, quite a page of information. We say to the first person, we whisper to the first person these sentences and say, now you transmit it to the next person. Don't let anyone else hear. Transmit, down the 20. But then you go to the next line of 20 people and do the same thing again, give them the same message, tell them to whisper it down the line. Go to the third line, down the line. Now, here's the thing. What happens at the end of that process of transmitting along 20 people, three lines of 20 people? You get to the last person in each of the three lines, get them to tell you what was said. If there are no differences between each of those three conclusions, what does it tell you about the process of transference that happens along those three lines? What does it tell you? It's extraordinarily accurate, because you've got three opportunities to test how well it happened. And if they all compare the same to each other, then you have an incredible process of conveying information accurately. Now, here's the thing. We don't just have 13,000 copies of one document, if you like. What we've got is John. John writes his book, and it's so important the Christians believe that they make four copies of it. They send one copy to Egypt, one copy to Rome, one copy to Antioch, and keep one in Jerusalem. Let's make it up, or in Ephesus, wherever it is. And they've got now four copies out there in different places. People there want to read it, so they make copies of each document in those various places, which gets copied and copied and copied and copied. But here's the thing. The copy in Alexandria of the copy never has any contact with the one in Rome. It's just being copied independently. And here's what scholars do. They compare all of those manuscripts in those different places and cities to see if they're any different from each other. And here's the thing. You look at any Bible that's a, you know, more than just the very basic, that's got footnotes, and I look on my page, Matthew 21, verse 44, some manuscripts do not have verse 44. What that's telling you is that, you know, some of these copies from this family tree of copying don't actually have verse 44 in it. And you're kind of like, wow, that's terrible. No. On a whole page of text, the only difference in that whole page is that verse. Everything else is the same. You go to the next page and there aren't any differences. The accuracy with which they recorded these things is astonishing. Now, we'd love to invite you to our Life series. We've got some richer and more profound information about all of this kind of stuff that people come away from after life just going, I had no idea. The evidence is so extraordinary. What you read in this book is so accurate to the events that for us it is clearly evidence of the existence of Jesus. He is a concrete, indisputable part of history. Now, in future weeks, we will look at what he said and did. And the events of Jesus are so extraordinary. His life is so extraordinary that he is powerfully attractive. He's an astonishing person. And the more you get to know him, the more you are drawn to him. Well, though, what about the books in recent times that are pushing the case that Jesus didn't exist? I mentioned Richard Dawkins, and we don't need to go back there, but he made a quote where he says a serious historical case can be made that Jesus didn't exist, and he mentions a professor of London University, a man called G.A. Wells. You chase it through, and you find that the professor that he quotes from is a professor of German at London University. He's not even a professor of history. Now, remember again, not one serious historian, Jewish, secular, or Christian, takes these arguments that are presented in these books with any seriousness. They just have no validity. The evidence to the contrary is too great. Now, all of this makes you ask another question. Well, it makes me ask another question. Why is it then that someone like Dawkins can pay so much attention to the unqualified professor and the opinion that he holds? In fact, to push it further, why is it that the producers of a documentary on Discovery Channel, which set out to debunk the existence of Jesus, why do they use the same professor? I'll tell you why, and this is just straight information. After scouring for months, the producers of that documentary looked for scholars to back up the ideas they were presenting and couldn't find any, so they put up the professor from London University, who was a professor of German, and didn't say anything except professor of London University. Didn't mention professor of German at London University, because that wouldn't have much impact. Now, it's tempting, of course, to go to some big conspiracy theory, but I tell you what, the answer is far more personal, it's far closer to home, and it impacts all of us. The question about who Jesus is profoundly confrontational. Jesus is literally, Jesus is the one who knocks on the door of your life tonight and says, "You are not your own. I made you. You're mine, and I'm coming back to have you back." You can't keep living as if you own your life. You're living in a world that isn't yours. You're living a life that is borrowed from me. You owe your existence and everything that you enjoy from me. And I'm coming back, and my resurrection from the dead is evidence, hard, concrete, physical evidence that I am coming back. Now, do you see what I'm trying to do? I'm trying really hard to take Christianity, biblical Christianity, out of the personal felt need issue, out of the subjective, if it works for you, it's good for you, if it doesn't work for you, it's not. That's not what Christianity's about. And that, it seems to me, is where religion in general and Christianity in particular sits for people. We hear so often in the media that there's so little evidence, so they say, that no one can really know whether one religion's true and another one's false. And we end up getting to this place where we go, well, all I can rely on is my feelings. And I like this one and I don't like that one. And so that's where I'll settle. And or it might be you fall into the place of, look, I don't really have any need for these things and I can't see any compelling reason for them. I'm told there's not much evidence. And so God will surely understand. And God says, I've given you an incredible amount of evidence. It's not the evidence that'll chase you down the street and make you believe against your will, but it is the evidence that's there to be found if you would but just look. But why don't we want to look? Because we don't want to find. Let me tell you a story about myself. Now, I'm innately uninteresting, but bear with this. 30 years ago, which is a long time ago, these things came home to me. I didn't grow up in a religious home. My family was just into sport, the beach. They were just all busy with that world. But I was puzzling about life. I was puzzling about how we were here, why we're here. I didn't have any great personal crisis. I didn't have any deep, you know, I wasn't kind of psychotic and depressive. I didn't have any deep needs. And I was just wondering about life, genuinely puzzled. And a friend said to me, gee, you ought to read the Bible. I think it's got some stuff there about these issues. And he himself wasn't particularly interested, but he'd heard it was. So I thought, okay, I'll have a look at it. And it made me start looking at the evidences for Christianity, and I was astonished. For me, it was the best-kept secret. How come no one's talking about this stuff? I read about the claims that Jesus made. I read Matthew 21, and my jaw dropped. The end of the gospel just before he's crucified, they ask him, "Are you the Son of God? Are you this one sent from God as his son?" And Jesus says, "Just as you have said. And I tell you, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God, coming on the clouds of heaven." And the Jewish leaders tore their clothes and said, "How dare you talk like this? The claim Jesus made is astonishing, but he backed it up. We'll look at it next week. He backed it up. Now, it dawned on me. It dawned on me that I was living in someone else's house. I was living the life that someone else had given me. And this was exactly the words that came to me, although I can still remember them, even though it's 30 years ago. I realized I was using God. I was using him. It's his world, it's his life, and I'm just living without any regard to the one who's giving me all these things all the time. I was using him. It dawned on me then, to pay no regard to the giver is to be offensive as those tenants were to the owner. It was to offend against God. And as soon as I realized that was the category, I realized it wasn't about whether I needed a crutch or not. It's not whether I had any personal need or feeling that I really wanted this. It was just about the truth. Is this true? The issue then of integrity kicked in. I realized that if Jesus is who he says he is, for me to continue living ignoring him was living dishonestly. It was to use him, and in integrity, I could not bear that. Now I saw, therefore, why I needed to turn back. Now other things hit me at the same time. I realised that Jesus, as I read the accounts of his life, wasn't just coming to give me bare facts and kind of brutally honest assessments, although he did do all of that in the accounts, but he was actually coming with this amazing love, this warmth and concern to seek and save the lost, even the people who didn't know they were lost. He was wanting them to come home and find the life that he'd always intended for them. I was made by him and for him, and I realized that it was a great privilege and a joy to actually find him. Now tonight, we've got a few minutes for questions, but let me offer this in conclusion and then see if you do want to ask anything. There are a couple of different groups amongst us tonight, and it'll be the case over these next weeks. I want to say to you, there are many amongst us who have decided to acknowledge the truth of these things, and you've given yourself to Jesus, and that's awesome. That's many of you. But I want to keep banging away at this with you. I want to keep telling you to be aware of emotionalism. Be aware of emotionalism. What's emotionalism? Emotionalism isn't that I ought not feel any emotions. No, emotions are good. Emotionalism is when you build your Christianity on how you feel. And so you search for the next high in church. You search for the next worship experience that makes you soar. And you search for the feelings, the back of the neck, which gives you confidence, there is a God, I can feel him. Begs a question, what do you know what feeling God feels like? How do you know what it is to feel God? Oh, no one tells you what it is. How do you know it's the tingle? How do you know that's not satanic? Well, because it feels so good. You don't think Satan can actually give you good feelings? Do you know what I mean? Like, just don't build your Christianity. I'll tell you why not. Firstly, Christianity is not founded in feelings, it's founded in fact. But I'll tell you why not as well. If you build your Christianity in feeling and emotion, then that will not be strong enough to sustain you through the horrible, ugly things of life and the dark times that will come. Please remember this. At heart, Christianity is a claim about the identity of Jesus, and the truth of that claim is true no matter how you feel. That's liberating. It's true whether or not your prayers are answered. It's true whether you're depressed or excited, whether you love church or get bored with churches. It's true. It's true whether life's working out and is a success for you or it isn't. It's true. It's true independent of these things. It's true when it's acceptable to follow him and everyone around you is encouraging you to do it. And it's true when it's unacceptable and everyone's discouraged. It's true. Because it's not founded on how you feel. We aren't left with vague ideas and wishful thinking, but unshakable facts, which means this, friends. I can stand at a funeral, as I often do, and I can declare to people who are grieving deeply at the loss of a friend, a family, a father, a wife, a child, and I can say with absolute confidence that in the midst of this grief and pain, there is a hope to come. And it's grounded in the truth, the facts about who this man is, which you can test yourself and find out, which gives us absolute confidence and certainty that we will have eternity together with the Lord Jesus. Don't give yourself into emotionalism. But there are many amongst us tonight and through the day, actually, who are considering these questions. You're not someone who's convinced yet, you're considering. We love it that you're here, and that's the way you've got to be. You've got to explore these things. Can I say to you a couple of things? The first one is this. Please be aware, on this issue, there's no fence. On this issue, there's no fence. If you feel like saying, look, I hear it all, I just don't care, you need to own the fact that that really is you saying, I don't believe it. That's okay. I mean, I think it's a dumb thing to do, but I mean, if you want to come to that conclusion after looking at the evidence, perfectly legitimate to do. But don't pretend you can sit on a fence. There is no fence with this one. And secondly, this isn't really about whether it will make a difference in your life, first and foremost. It's not even about whether it will make you feel good or feel right, although it will do all of that. It is first and foremost about whether this man is who he says he is. And can I urge you to explore that evidence? Now I'm going to take a pause. Do you want to ask anything? And if we can have the lights up, that would help me, unless they're already up and I just can't see. But do you want to ask anything? That's a bit better. Yeah, good. Do you want to ask anything? Yeah. I think there's a microphone.
So you're saying there's 13,000 copies of the original documents, and so what I'm asking is, there's like all different versions of the Bible today. How do you know which one's more credible than the other one?
Okay. We have, what we've got is the original New Testament was written in Greek. That Greek was then translated into Latin and German and English and French and Italian, all kinds of languages. And some of the English translations that we've got from that original Greek were translated to make it very simple to read. So kind of simple sentence structures. Some of it were, no, let's make it really close, as close to the text as we can, so it's a little bit more difficult to read. Because Greek doesn't read like English. It reads like Yoda, it does. do you know what I mean? Like, it puts the verbs in different places, and so odd it is. And so when you do a literal translation of the Greek straight into English, word for word, it's kind of awkward to read. And so what we've done is we've tried to massage it to make it easy for English people to read. Now, well, the point there is that the English translations are not the document that the original guys wrote. They wrote in Greek. Well, how can I know what they wrote then? Learn Greek. Now, this is no great shakes. I read Greek. So when I was made to learn Greek, and a number of the guys amongst us, Hazy, we can read Greek, the text. So we can read the original writings. And you can check out whether the English is a good representation of the original Greek. And the version we use, which is the new international version, is very, very good. There's a few places you'd want to go, oh, you could have added that word there to make it the sense of it come through a bit better, but it's very good. Does that help? I think you should have ministers who can read Greek. Yeah.
I think I missed the circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, I didn't give any. The circumstantial evidence is... thank you. I just scooted through. The circumstantial evidence is something happened. Something happened to turn a whole bunch of cowards, which is what the records tell us they were, into heroes. You got a bunch of fishermen. When a slave girl speaks to them, says, aren't you one of Jesus' followers? They run and hide. They were cowards. But then some weeks later, That very person who ran and hid from a slave girl stands up in front of 3,000 angry, hostile Jews and says, "You killed the Lord of glory." You can read about it in Acts chapter 2. That is the most courageous thing I've ever read. What happened to change that? Something's changed it. What they said changed it was that they saw this man rise from the grave. That'd do it. That'd do it. They saw Jesus rise from the grave and they went to their deaths declaring it happened. Now, that's not direct evidence, it's circumstantial evidence, but it's powerful. Yeah. There you go. You want to ask anything else? Oh, sorry. Yeah, good question. We talked about some differences between the manuscripts. How significant are they to the core message? Well, as I say, the major ones are recorded in the version we use, so the New International Version. At the bottom of the page, each page, you'll find every now and then, I'm looking, there's none there. You haven't got a lot. You will find... Yeah, there are some, and I'll try and find one for you. But you see the point? Now, here's another little thing, and I've done this with you in the past, but one of the versions of the Greek Bible, you know, different companies put together, you know, printed for you, you see. One of the printed Greek Bibles, one of the ones I've got, and I don't know if others around have got this too, but at the bottom of the page it's called the textual apparatus, and it gives you every single difference between the manuscripts. And the vast majority of them are spelling differences. They're just spelling differences. I couldn't even think of an illustration for it. They change no meaning. They change no significance. There's only three substantial places in the whole of the New Testament where there's any major discrepancies amongst the texts. It's the end of Mark's Gospel, chapter 16, verse 9 to the end, is not in many of the earlier manuscripts. But when you look at it, you've got the same information in other places in the Bible, so it doesn't change anything. Although that is but what you find in all the new translations, they'll tell you that. So there's no hidden bits. There's nothing of any substance impacted by the changes. They really are very small. Now you think to yourself, oh, really, is that the case? Just go and check it out. I mean, it's not like this stuff's hidden. You can look at it. It's really very insignificant. 99.9%. Bang, nailed. It's scary, isn't it?
If so many scholars like agree that Jesus existed, how come they're not all Christians?
Good question. So if all these scholars believe Jesus existed, how come they're not all Christians? Well, we'll come to that in future weeks. You see, the claims that Jesus makes, it's not simply you've got the fact that he existed, indisputable. Now what do I make of his existence? What do I make of the significance of what he says of himself? Well, that is a next step to wrestle with, you see. And a lot of people don't want to go the next step. But it's a process of let's look at the information, let's look at the evidence. Is he really who he says he is? And I could take any historian through that, and many people are doing that around the world and wrestling, and people are coming to Christ as they work with the evidence. But that's what you've got. You're wrestling with the fact and then the significance of those facts. Yeah. Yeah, good. Just yell.
So when you're talking about
how good is this building? You really did forget what you were saying. Do you want to come back to you? I'd love to hear your question, but got something else? Nothing else? Tell me when you got it. Yeah, you got it. Good, 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 good.
Why
Yeah, good question. So why can you, that's a very helpful, why can you say that a gap of 30 years between the events and the recording of them is not a big gap when today you'd kind of go, that seems quite extraordinary? A couple of things. You're dealing with a culture and a series of ancient cultures that were oral, non-internet people, non-printing press people, non-computer people. Now, we don't get this, but that changes your culture. And you see it evidenced. What it does is it forces people, when you haven't got access like we have to copiers and so on, it forces people to get better at memory. You may not appreciate that, but you can develop your memory in cultures. There's some of the stuff we used to show at the Life series. There's evidence of 13-year-old Muslim boys who can memorise books of the Quran, whole sections of the Quran, word perfect. Now, that's because they've got, their culture gives them a heightened commitment to accuracy of memory. Now, in the first century, the whole process of oral transference, the passing of information, was a powerful part of their lives. They were very good at it. Now, there was therefore no felt need to immediately write it all down, except for this. And we've never talked about this here, but let me tell you, Matthew's gospel trades upon an earlier document. Luke's, all of these other documents, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, scholars have identified sitting beneath them is an earlier written document that goes back many years before they wrote, which they looked at to help write their works. Q in German. And so you've got these series of letters and initials that represent these original documents, which therefore means things were written down and then Matthew finalised his document. But the distance between those records in that culture and tradition was not great at all, and the accuracy. Now, of course, you add into this the fact that you've got Matthew writing independently of John. They didn't sit in a study together and write their works. Different place, different time, writing their recollections of Jesus. When you compare those independent eyewitness accounts, which is what they both were, you can cross-check to see whether they remembered accurately what happened. And the astonishing thing you find, if you want to look, and I did, is that the differences between them are just so minuscule that you're dealing with simple, primitive, naive recollection. I was there. I saw it happen. Astonishing. And the accuracy, therefore, of the recollection is amazing, given the culture and given the context in the ancient world. Yeah. I'd love to take you through, and if there's another question, I'll mention a couple other things, but I'd love to take you through some of the indicators through the text of the naive character of the eyewitness histories. I'll give you just one quick taste. In the ancient world, they didn't have a lot of imagination with names. So, you know, the name Mary was given to every third woman. You know, the name Matthew was very popular and the name James was very popular, Simon and so on. Now, what happens in a context where everyone's got the same name, you have to use another attribution to distinguish which James you meant. Got it? Now, we've got a massive literature from the ancient world now, from the first century, and we can tell you which names were most popular in the ancient world. Now, what's extraordinary is, when you read these accounts of the things that happened, what you'll find is that the author, Matthew, when he says James, he doesn't just say James, he says James, son of James, you know, he distinguishes which James he means because it was such a popular name. He's just telling you the way it is because that's the way it was. He's just telling you what happened because it's so natural to him to write like this. And the evidences of that through these accounts is astonishing. Love to unpack it more with you. Okay, I'm going to finish up. Friends, just want to leave you with this. This stuff is amazing. I've made the claim that it is the most important issue facing humanity. You may not have followed everything tonight, but that you work this stuff out is the most important issue you can deal with. And I'd urge you to keep doing it with us. Okay.